today. Like, he's going to tell us about the gravitational origin of the weak interactions, chirality. Stephen, please begin.
Okay, it's great to be given this talk, and hopefully we all get something good out of it. So let me I guess everyone now has the slides of the talk with in front of them. So I'm now on page 2 where I want to just acknowledge my collaborators on this project, on this paper, which is, you can find it on the archive. Unfortunately, I don't have the archive number, but if you look up me, Antonino Marciano, my postdoc, and Lee Smolin, it's that paper with exactly the same title. Just want to acknowledge my my collaborators. And on the third page, we use work from the following authors on the third page. These are all the people that contributed also in the spirit of the references. There's a little error I made here. At the bottom, you'll see a Capovilla and Smolin. That paper doesn't exist. It's actually Capovilla, Dell, and DeLyra. Moving on to the fourth slide. What motivates this project? Could everyone hear me?
Yes, sure. Hello? We can hear you.
Okay. So on the fourth slide, what motivated this project is a couple of questions, outstanding questions. The first question is, why is the weak interaction maximally parity violating? Now, this is when we look at the standard model, this characteristic is put in by hand. And our friends that do string theory, this question was taken very seriously, and that led to what is known as the heterotic string theory. So, you know, in the context of loop quantum gravity, spin foam, it's a useful question to ask, should we ever think of combining the other forces, the other matter couplings, to the spin foam? So asking that question, I think, is a valuable question. And another question related to this is, why is the standard model chiral? Now, a hint as to what that answer could be is the third point. Gravity actually shares something in common with the weak interaction, in that both interactions, gravity and the weak force, interact universally with all fermions. And by that, I mean, if we look at the matter content in the standard model, the fermions consist of leptons and quarks. And what I'm saying is that the weak interaction interacts universally with all leptons and quarks, unlike the strong interaction, for example. Okay. Now, to clarify what I'm, you know, and distinguish what I mean by chirality and parity, I provide a little toy model in the next slide. So if we stare at this Lagrangian, okay, I want to explore this Lagrangian and use this to teach us a few things about chirality and parity violation before I move on to, you know, a more complicated theory. So the question is, in this theory, what about this theory is chiral? So I claim that this theory is chiral. And it's chiral because all the left-handed connection only couples to the left-handed fermion current, and the right-handed connection only couples to the right-handed fermion current. And I don't have any mixed couplings like left and right, for example. So we have an explicit coupling of left-handed fields to other left-handed fields. And that's what I mean by chirality here. Now, what about parity? Well, parity is when I invert left to right. If I look at this Lagrangian, I invert left to right. I take A left to A right and J left to J right. That's a parity transformation. You see that this theory is not parity. This theory could, what we learned here, this theory could be chiral and parity violated. Because unless G, the coupling G1 and G2 go into each other, this theory is parity violated. But it can also be chiral. So it's important to distinguish chirality from parity violation. However, if G1 is equal to G2, the theory is both chiral and parity symmetric. But what do I mean by maximal parity violation? Well, maximally parity violation, if, for example, if G2 is vanishing, or the couple or the connection is not there, and I only have A left and J left, this theory is now said to be maximally parity violation. And that's the case that the weak interaction finds itself. It's both chiral and maximally parity violated, in the sense that there are no right-handed couplings, okay, to the right-handed gate weak fields. Any questions there? All right. So why is this important? Well, without parity violation, there'd be no life on Earth. There'd be no you and I, because the most basic process, what I mean by that, when the sun produces heavier elements, these heavier elements have to decay into things like oxygen and carbon. But if you didn't have parity violation, then when we look at how a neutron decays into a proton, or basically how an up quark, if we look at this diagram here, decays into a down quark to emit a W boson, an electron, a beta particle, and an antineutrino, if that process is parity symmetric, you would never have beta decay, and therefore you would never have elements decaying into each other through beta decay. And to show you a depiction of what I mean by that is that if I look at this process of an up quark going into a down quark by emitting a left-handed W boson, the mirror image does not exist. And this has been shown in experiment, and of course, this is what the Nobel Prize was given for. And what I'm asking here is, where does this come from? Okay? It is put in by hand in the Standard Model. So the lesson here is that parity violation can emerge from a chiral and parity symmetric mother theory, perhaps. So the idea here is that we seek to find an electroweak theory from a mother theory, some sort of mother theory that is both chiral, so it resembles the toy model that we had, parity symmetric, and parity symmetric. And then we ask whether or not there is some parity violating solution that could give us the electroweak interaction or a part of the electroweak interaction that's parity violated. But so what could this be? Okay. So I'm going to skip a couple of slides here because of brevity. So I gave this talk at Dartmouth to a bunch of graduate students who don't know the language of BS theory. So let's skip this exercise of how we get, how from BF theory we can get general relativity with positive cosmological constant. Most of us, in fact, all of us know, are very familiar with it. And now I'm going to move to a page called isogravity. Please bear me for a second. I just have to go get some water. Okay, so in 2007, while I was a faculty at Penn State, and I miss my colleagues at Penn State dearly, I would go see Abai and ask him questions about the Ashtekov variables. This is where I learned all of this stuff, most of it. And during that time, something very intriguing occurred. I was deeply thinking, me and a postdoc at the time, Florian Conradi, we were thinking very deeply about parity violation and the weak interaction and how this may be connected to the to the Ashtekov formulation of general relativity. And something interesting happened there. And I call this paper isogravity, and Nesty and Pekachi call it gravity weak unification. We wrote this, we put this paper out 3 days within each other and independently. And so this was where a part of this original idea started with. And so the basic idea is to view gravity, as we all know, as a gauge theory with a connection valued in SO31 complex. Now, of course, what we're talking about here is a complexified Ashtekov variable. And in this case, group theory tells us that this splits up into a left-handed SLPC connection and a right-handed SLPC connection. And, well, this is just realized by the fact that this the complex Ashtekov variable is chiral. Let's move on. So I'm going to spell out the basic idea. So in 1984, Jacobson and Smolin showed that if you treated one of the, now we're talking about a four-dimensional story here, okay? If you treat one of the SLC connections, let's call SLPC right, the convention, for gravity, and you just set the other connection to zero, okay? Then you just get back general relativity. Okay, so this is a well-known story. But in this case, what we're doing is we're keeping both connections. keep in both connections. We treat one of the connections, according to Jacobson and Smolin, as the gravitational connection. And we're going to imagine, we haven't instantiated this yet, but we're going to imagine that the other SO2 connection is the weak interaction. Okay, now this is a bold claim we have to do. We're going to show this in this talk. And if we do this, then somehow this mother theory, right, is going to be parity invariant because we have both connections and we are setting the couplings to be such that the theory is parity invariant. And so the question we're going to ask about this mother theory, which I haven't presented to you yet, is there a parity violating vector, meaning are there solutions, and what are they? I mean, so let's move on to the next slide. And it was known for some time by Kirill Krasnov and Lee Smolin that you can extend this BF theory, this Plobansky theory, and the extension really occurs on the second line there, where I can imagine shift in the cosmological constant by this auxiliary field, G squared psi squared. And this theory is parity violating, actually, because we have this FF dual term. So let's set alpha to zero, and we're only going to consider the first three terms in this extended Plobansky theory. And what I'm claiming is that this theory has a phase that's parity violating that gives us both the weak interaction and general relativity. That's a claim. All right. So what do we know about this theory? So this theory is well studied, and our colleagues Kirill Krasnov and Sergey and collaborator Simone spent a lot of hard work studying this theory in the parity symmetric case. And they found some beautiful results. I'll discuss that very shortly. But that parity symmetric sector actually has a scale of ghost, which is very interesting, actually. And in our case, we explored a parity violating sector of this theory that is stable. And what I mean by that is stable in terms of a perturbative expansion in the solution. So to study this, what we need to first do is take this extended BF theory, the Plobansky theory, and explicitly write it in a chiral manner. So to do that, we're going to split our Lorentzian connection, connection into manifestly spinorial indices. So if you look here, these indices are just the usual, we denoted by a prime and an unprime convention, which run from 0 to 1. And so you can do this using the van der Voorden map. So in this case, if I look at AAD, where AB are Lorentzian indices, I can split this into AA prime and BB prime by using this epsilon tensor. So we can split into a left-handed connection and a right-handed connection. And so if I write my action, you notice that I basically get a doubling of the term for the BF and BB, for example. And this theory, if I swap A prime to A and B prime to B, you find that the theory looks the same. So this theory is parity invariant, but it's written in a chirally in a chiral manner. And if I vary this action with respect to B, the Lagrange multiplier, and A, I get the following equations of motion. And let's focus on these equations of motion. The equations of motion for B, for example, and also the Lagrange multiplier, are all parity symmetric in the sense that if I swap again A and A prime and B and B prime, all of the equations of motion will be symmetric under that swap. So Simone, for example, looked at the symmetric solution, and he showed that his theory is actually a bimetric theory that has two spin two fields, one a massless graviton and a massive graviton, and a ghost scalar. So there are 8 degrees of freedom in this theory. And you can obtain that solution by expanding the B field by the coupling, which is small, okay? And you can expand it about some background B field plus some expansion of some small B field. And if you solve the equation of motion that I presented to you above, order by order, you will get basically those 8 degrees of freedom. All right. I ask you all to look at Simone's beautiful paper on that. It's very clearly written and step and urge you to read those papers. And these papers were followed up also by Sergey and Kirill and collaborators. Okay. What we want to now study is a case of interest, which is a parity-breaking solution. What we're going to claim is that this phase, the solutions reorganize themselves to have one graviton and a triplet of sp2 gauge fields, still giving us 8 degrees of freedom. So we get, and this happens, okay, so now we want to go back and stare at the equations of motion. So this happened both when the coupling constant is small, but something else happened, which is the following. That the right-handed field strength, okay, so if I go back to the equations of motion, and I look at the right-handed field strength, the second term there, I'm sorry, the first term, if this term is dominated by the cosmological constant, so if there's a lambda over 3g, okay, if this term is dominated by the cosmological constant, so we imagine that some reason that we have a dominance of the cosmological constant and the coupling constant is small. Okay, so there it goes. What we want to do is rewrite this, the equation of motion, in terms of a new dimensionless parameter, which is a multiplication of this dimensionless coupling constant, which is small lambda, times g squared. And what we want to do is find self-consistent solutions. In other words, what we're going to do is expand the B field, okay, by a tiny parameter, very similar to what Simone did. But we're going to seek for solutions that are also dominated by the cosmological constant. And we're going to see if we get self-consistent solutions. In other words, all solutions that are generated are going to fall off for higher order terms in G squared. That's the question. And if you look at the next slide, we do find a solution. And to get more details, please look at our paper because it was quite a hairy calculation to do. But what we find is that we have F A prime B prime just becomes proportional to a term that it goes as 1 over G squared, for example, minus lambda times B8A prime B prime. So what we see is a mix in here. The real trick to this is that FA prime B prime gets related to so the left-handed connection gets mixed in with the right-handed connection. And to check that this is correct, we find that the solution of B8A prime B prime, if you look at the bottom of that slide, falls off at in terms of g squared and g to the sixth. So what we can do now is take the solution for
sorry,
b.
Sorry, Stephen, I have a question. This is Laurent. What distinguishes from at this point the left sector from the right sector? I missed it in the equation.
Okay, yes, thank you very much. There is one more thing that I forgot. I'm going to go to the previous slide, and that's actually, thanks for raising that question. There was one other condition that I did not include in the slide, which does that, Laurent. And for that, I have to pull something up. I'm now pulling up the paper, okay? So in the paper, there's another condition that is also important, and it has to be self-consistent as well. So thanks for bringing that up. Let me find that case. So you need two conditions. You need that... bear me for a second. I have to find that condition here. Okay. So you need two conditions, actually. You need a dominance of this lambda over 3G, and you also need the term, if you go back to the equations of motion, let me just find it in the slide. I'm vacillating between the slide and the paper. Okay. If you go back to the equation of motion here, and you look at the equations of motion for the auxiliary field, we have three of them. The last one is the one that has mixed indices. You see that term there? This is phi AB, A prime, B prime.
Yes.
So you also need to be dominated by that term as well. So that's you have two conditions. You're looking for solutions that are dominated by that term and also the cosmological constant. And that's the term that we're biased. It's a mixed indices term. But for that, you really have to go through the calculation in detail.
Sorry, if I understand properly, what distinguished left from right is the sign of the cosmological constant, because on the top...
The value. It has to be large. Not the sign, but it's the value, the magnitude. So you need to bias left from right by using this mixed term, psi AB, A prime, B prime, in the equation of motion for the auxiliary field, and you need the cosmological constant to be much larger than the coupling constant. Those are the two conditions. And we find self-consistent perturbative solutions.
Since we are on this slide, the equations of motion slide, students here would like to understand various symbols, namely, presumably big G is just Newton's constant.
Yes.
What is little g, what is big W, and what is little lambda?
Thank you for bringing that up. Let's go back to the original action, actually, in the previous slide. In terms of the original action, we have three parameters. We have the coupling constant, which couples the psi square term to the in the extended Lebesgue theory to the B wedge B. So that's the coupling constant there in the original action. And then we also have lambda, the dimensionless cosmological constant, which is big lambda times G in the original action. And we have the Newton's coupling. So we have three couplings in the original action. So little g is the coupling between the psi square, the auxiliary field, and the B wedge B.
We have alpha in this transparency, and
yes,
you have a W on the next.
That's part. Right. We set alpha equal to zero for everything that follows, because that would make the
series. And then what is W on the next transparency?
Okay, W is related to the determinant of the metric at the end of the day.
So W is a field?
Go ahead.
W is the trace of B wedge B. It's just a symbol for the trace of B wedge B.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so to proceed, let me go back to my thing. Okay. So what we have now is an action that organizes itself into two pieces that are zeroth order in the coupling constant, because we're expanding about the coupling constant, and we have higher order terms in terms of G squared. And if we now plug this back into the action by using the value of the auxiliary field and the solution of the B field, we have a zeroth order action. And this is going to be one of the most important parts of the talk. So let's stare at this. So sigma AB is nothing more than E wedge, the background, the usual background contraction of, I'm sorry, the wedge product of the tetrad. It's wedge FAB, and we recognize that term as just the good old-fashioned Einstein-Hilbert term. And then, of course, the second term is just the cosmological constant times the determinant of the metric. And that the unprime indices correspond to, in this case, I'm using my conventions, the left-handed part of the connection, okay? And the prime indices will correspond to the right-handed part of the connection. You can choose to call one whatever you want to call, left versus right. I'm just calling it left and right. So prime is right-handed, and unprime is left-handed. So if we look at the second term here, we have a prime indices, F prime, wedge, F dual. And we recognize that as an FU2 connection, and we immediately want to identify that with the weak interaction. Okay. And we have a theta term, a topological term, a CP, the CP violating term for the Yang-Mills, for the weak interaction. And we have higher order terms as well that are, highest dimension 8 operators, which are going to be irrelevant. But the thing that's very interesting is that the Yang-Mills coupling and the theta parameter are completely determined in terms of the original parameters of the mother series. So we have very little wiggle room in the sense that whatever the couplings of our mother theory is, and for example, the coupling constant that we expanded about, it better give us, you know, a well-defined Yang-Mills, one over G Yang-Mills that we know and believe today. And that's one thing we're going to... And we did find, actually, that we do get a small Yang-Mills coupling, as we should expect, for the weak interaction, okay, in terms of the parameters of the original theory. In other words, in terms of a small coupling constant, a small G bear in the original theory. And it'll be interesting to see what's the phenomenology of this theta term, for example. Okay. I want to now move on and talk about the assignments of the fermions, because this is also going to be a very novel thing. And I know that Lee is pursuing this this connection, well, pursuing this this idea in the near future. But the basic idea here is that a lepton, if you look at what a lepton is in this theory, it's really a tensor product between between two spinners. All right? And you have to, pardon me here, I've done a little change in my conventions. A and B, small a and B, are still spinorial indices. And you have to pardon me here that that B should have actually been a B prime, okay? And what I'm saying here is that the spin index will be, a lepton will have a spin index, which is what is the case. They spin 1.5 particles. But the other SU2, for example, that we spoke about, will now actually be identified with isospin. So if I take a tensor product of two spinners this way, what I'm telling you is that I can think of this tensor product as this matrix, for example, where an isospin doublet that would spin 1.5, like for example a neutrino, will take a component in that matrix, and a left-hand electron will also take a value in that matrix. So since we don't have a metric explicitly, we have to figure out how to couple our spinners, okay, to the B field. And luckily this was done by Jacobson, Dellen, Delilah. Lee, you might have to correct me on this. So I know that Ted was one of the players in this paper. But basically, And so if we look at now at Dirac Lagrangian for a left-handed field, we see the following wedge product between a spinner 1 form, and we introduce a Lagrange multiplier so that when we vary this thing with respect to the Lagrange multiplier's action, we can find solutions that we expect, which is we have a coupling of the tetrad to the spinner. I just want to clarify something. This bar does not mean any conjugation. It's just a notation to distinguish rho from lambda. Okay, so the bar does not mean conjugation. The conjugation occurs by the contraction in the spinorial basis. So if I rewrite this whole thing, the solution, I get what I usually expect, okay, for the left-handed Dirac field. But by symmetry, I should also have a right-handed coupling. If I do that in the next slide, unlike the unprime lepton, because I've identified the curvature tensor, I've identified the curvature tensor with the weak interaction. The fermions obey a different equation of motion, which has no simple general solution, and that's something that we're still thinking about and still pursuing. Okay. And we think this is related somehow to the Higgs mechanism, finding a solution, but that's just very speculative. We can get back to that if anyone has any more questions about that. Okay, so we're able to, the basic point is that we're able to now extend our action and couple fermions in a covariant way without regard to the metric. But this leads to a very interesting point, and that I will discuss after I discuss the reality condition. So, initially, all these fields are complex in Lorentzian case. So we need to specify reality conditions, and you know, this a lot of this was really big credit was it should be given to Lee for this part of the work. And so let me just go through those steps. So the first thing that we want to do is to not impose a reality condition in an asymmetric manner. So the way that reality conditions were done in the past, for example, was that you only started with one-handedness of the field and you impose reality conditions there. What we want to do is to impose a reality condition in the full symmetric series that includes both the left-handed and right-handed field. So to do that, the first thing we want to do is to differentiate the right and the left-handed two forms by breaking it up into left and right-handed pieces, and then define the left and right Urbanism as metrics. And so this is what I call G and G tilde, left and right. And impose the reality condition. The reality condition would be that G left is equal to G left conjugate and G right is equal to G right conjugate. So how do you impose that? So let's go back to our original action. And the way we will want to do this, well, first of all, why do you want to do that? Well, if you're able to do that, then what you'll find is that in the symmetric case, these left and right Urbanism metrics are going to be real. That's the first thing. But in the parity violating case, what we'll find is that the Yang-Mills connection will be real, and the right-handed and gravitational metric and connection will also be real. So the way this is imposed is by introducing a Lagrange multiplier in the original action. We'll see that in the last term here, where we introduce this lambda AB left and lambda AB right. And when we look at the equations of motion for B, for example, we see that this last term will vanish because the equation of motion for B, AB prime, this is now we have an equation of motion for B and also its conjugate, and that will yield a solution that you see below, which implies that for non-degenerate metrics, that lambda AB vanishes. And the same will apply also for the reality of the right-handed field. All right, so now I want to return back to the physics here, because this is where this gets very interesting. Because of the identification we were forced to make, in other words, that the left-handed connection, now I'm forgetting my convention, that one-handedness is gravity and the other-handedness is a weak interaction. This means that that a left-handed spinner, okay, transforms like a doublet scalar, like a weak doublet scalar, because it transforms like isospin. But the components are scalar quantities. And so we can ask ourselves, what entity actually carries this quantum number? So that's a question I have for the audience. Any answers? So what's the particle that transforms as a weak doublet scalar? And the answer is the Higgs field. Okay. And the right-handed spinner...
Sorry. Stefan, can you explain a bit more this point where it comes from, the
prediction? Well, it just came from the fact that we showed that the left-handed connection, or the left-handed spinner, I'm sorry, a spinner in the A, so we have A and A prime, which I call left and right. The left-handed one transforms like a spin degree of freedom, like it has spin. And the other one carries isospin quantum numbers, right? So now, if I now look at my theory, now I have what I used to think to be a right a particle that's spinning with respect to the Lorentzian connection, a right-handed spin, actually is transforming as an isospin. Okay, it has no spin, but it transforms under isospin.
Sorry, are you saying that the right index are become isospin index?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes. So if I take a spinner, let me call it psi. If A is the isospin, right, and I write psi A, it's transforming, right, as a singlet under the spin group, under, the spin, but a doublet under the isospin, because it has only one index, right? And that index is an isospin index. So, a Higgs particle, right, is a singlet under the Lorentz group, right? But it's a doublet under isospin. It's a spin zero particle that transforms under isospin. Okay. So what I'm saying is that this identification happens naturally in our scheme. I saw a theory of only fermionic coupling, but when I have a parity violating solution, I immediately identify this thing with the weak interaction, because that's the way that connection is coupling, right? I have an F squared term, and I have I have the covariant derivative acting on those spinners, but they're really isospin now. And also conversely, a right-handed spinner transforms like a weak singlet with spin 1/2. Just conversely, right? Just the same logic here. And that's actually a neutrino. That's a right-handed neutrino. Now, what's really interesting is that if I look at the standard model and I want to give neutrinos masses, the minimal thing I can do is to add a right-handed neutrino. And this quantum number comes out naturally in our scheme as well. And so what's interesting here is that in the symmetric phase, the right-handed neutrino and the Higgs particle are parity. They relate to each other by a parity transformation. They transform into each other under a parity transformation, and they are distinguished from each other in the parity violating phase. And that's obviously in future work going to have very interesting phenomenology, because right now, actually, as we speak, we are looking for the spiral neutrino in the Large Hadron Collider. When I say we, the people at the Large Hadron Collider, right? They're looking for electroweak scale spiral neutrinos. All right. So that's one set of predictions. And the other set of predictions in our model is we can extend our theory very easily to incorporate the U1, okay, up the SU2 cross U1. And again, this is credit given to Lee's insight that we, by extending the group SL2C to GL2C, you can show that locally that is equivalent to SL2C cross U1. And if you go through the calculation, we do find the U1 hypercharge, but we find new terms. And I just wrote those terms down. So small f is actually is going to be the new U1, and I call that a dark hypercharge because it doesn't couple to the visible sector. Okay, and the big F is our usual field strength tensor for the hypercharge in the standard model. And notice what we have: we have kinetic terms and topological terms for the dark hypercharges, but we also have interaction between the dark sector, if you look at the last term, and the visible sector. And we have not explored the phenomenology of this. That's way beyond the scope of this work. So the next slide, we want to talk about novel features.
Yes? It's Isabel here. It's Isabel from AI. Can I ask a question? In this your extension here for the dark hypercharge, so you have the Young-Mills coupling constant. Do you need to fine-tune it to the one which you get earlier on from the gravitational?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question, and I'm going to address that in the next slide. So it's very interesting that you raised that question, because if you look at the two U1 factors there, right, the small f and the big f, they actually have the same Young-Mills coupling constant, as the SU2 Yang-Mills factor. Okay, so there's so I hope that answers your question.
Well, not really yet. So they have it, but you just put it. I didn't understand if you put it by hand that they have the same thing, or that that it comes out naturally. And if it does come out,
yeah, it comes out naturally. Yeah, that coupling, the same Yang-Mills coupling, comes out naturally. So if I look at the first kinetic term there, small f, it has a 1 over g Yang-Mills squared. That comes out naturally in the calculation.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. And you have, of course, higher order terms here that goes as g squared over e, but those terms are highly suppressed. So you do have coupling constant unification relative to the U1 factors and the SU2, both dark and visible. All right? However, they will couple differently to matter, okay? Which is basically what I showed before. The other thing is that there's a universal four-point coupling of the vector potential for the dimension 8 operators. Okay, so those are the three things we immediately read off from that, from this new sector. Okay, so that's pretty much it, okay? I wanted to sort of leave some time for questions. So let me just conclude with what we found. We found that chirality and parity violation in the electric weak theory arises from its other gravitational hand. We also found that the quantum numbers of the Higgs and the star neutrino arise naturally in this scheme, in the parity violating sector. And we expect new predictions for the upcoming LHC because we do have the star neutrino in our picture. We have this dark sector, and these are things that are currently under investigation under the Large Hadron Collider. We just need to find a really smart phenomenologist to help us out. The thing that's very intriguing, to me at least, is that the cosmological constant, a large cosmological constant in this case, plays an important role in parity violation. And this seems to suggest something, a different way of thinking about the cosmological constant problem, which is that we might need it to be large in the ultraviolet to cancel the other contributions coming from the matter field. And maybe that the fact that we get this parity violating solution in the phase where the cosmological constant is large, it's telling us something. Okay. And another interesting thing from just a gravitational perspective is, since our colleagues have been working on the gravitational sector, for example, the biometric version that Simone found, it'll be interesting to now explore the cosmological consequences of this modified gravity theory, both in the parity symmetric and the parity violating sectors. Of course, the hardest question here is how do we think about this modified theory in the context of quantum gravity? And then finally, what is the identity of these auxiliary fields? I mean, they were put in there, they gave us what we wanted, but it'll be interesting to put some physics behind that, and this is some work that we're currently under investigation with Ettore and Antonino. Thank you very much for your time.
Any further questions?
I have one, Laurent from Perimeter. It's about, as you mentioned at some point in the biometric theory, there is a scalar here which is stable initially.
Yes.
Somehow it disappeared in your treatment, so what happened to it? How did you treat it?
Well, I mean, we haven't... I mean, so the best we were able to do about it, first of all, that's a good question, and I think that should be explored. And we did not explore really the connection between this symmetric theory and the asymmetric theory. It'll be interesting to really study that in detail. But let me add some sort of experience, intuition with it. Let's consider the Higgs mechanism. So in the Higgs mechanism, we have a tachyonic instability, which drives you from an unstable saddle point, which is the top of the Mexican half potential, to a stable symmetry breaking solution, which is the bottom of the well. And we're expecting a similar thing, that basically what this goes to sound is that the theory in the symmetric case, like the Higgs mechanism, is unstable. And that when and the parity violating solution is like the bottom of the Mexican hat. And what we would like to do is figure out how to interpolate from one to the other. And that will tell us how those fields reorganize themselves. Of course, the way that happens in the Higgs mechanism is that the gauge field is that the vector modes become massive, right? So that unstable mode is eaten up by the massive vector mode. So we would expect to hopefully find a similar thing here. I don't know. But that's a good question. That's the best I can do.
Can I stress that the broken symmetry phase is stable, and the degrees of freedom, as Stefan said, rearrange themselves. So the 8 degrees of freedom of the symmetric phase, which are the graviton, the massive spin 2, and this unstable ghost, rearrange themselves into a triplet of spin 1 mode of the Young-Mills field, and the graviton remains massless. And the perturbative action expanding around the, once you shift the field to the new minimum, the perturbative action is completely positive definite and therefore stable. So it is exactly analogous to the analogy that Stefan mentioned with the Higgs mechanism.
Okay. I guess I'm confused about that, because if I have two spin 2 fields, then I can convert one into a spin 1 field, but I still need an extra scalar mode. So I'm wondering, where is this extra scalar mode encoded into?
No, the spin ones are massless, so there's no scalar mode at all.
Yeah, that's the problem. Initially, there's a scalar mode, and then in your theory, the scalar mode has disappeared.
Scalar mode has disappeared. It's become the five massive spin 2 plus the scalar mode, which is 6 degrees of freedom, become the spin change, and the reason it become the 6 degrees of freedom of the massive SP2 Yang Mill.
Yeah, that's exactly the case.
The massless has the same numbers of degrees of freedom as the spin 2 graviton. I mean, there are different spins, but the number of degrees of freedom is the same.
Right, so the counting is that the 5 degrees of what's disappeared in going from the symmetric to the asymmetric phase, a massive spin 2 has disappeared, that's 5 degrees of freedom, and a ghost scalar has disappeared, that's 6 degrees of freedom. And they've been replaced by a triplet of massless, that's the 2 bare fields, which is 6.
Hello?
Somebody's playing with their mic. Can they just stop playing, because it is causing huge static?
Thanks.
Okay, so shall I repeat? What's disappeared are 6 degrees of freedom, which are the 5 degrees of freedom of a massive spin 2 and 1 degree of freedom of a ghost scalar. Those 6 degrees of freedom have disappeared. They've been replaced by the 6 degrees of freedom of a triplet of massive spin 1 fields corresponding to the SP2 gauge field, the SP2 Young-Hill gauge field. The reason why the...
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. I think maybe we need to... Yeah, the sound is not... I don't... Yeah, we cannot hear you.
I can hear... This is a very important point, so I would like Lee to repeat that, actually.
Stefan, if they can hear you better, why don't you repeat it?
Maybe, Stefan, can you say it? Because we cannot hear Lee properly.
Yeah, so in both cases, we have 8 degrees of freedom. And so in the case where you have, what's going on is that the massive, the 5 degrees of freedom, we have 6 degrees of freedom that become a massive vector mode, which is a gauge field, the triplet of gauge fields. That's the first thing. So the... Hello? Massless.
Massless.
Yeah, massless. So that's hello. No, I can't. Can everyone hear me?
Did you say massless or massive?
Massless. And we have the other degrees of freedom correspond to one spin two field. Okay, and the reason why this is happening is because we in the symmetric case you have two metrics. Okay, it's a bimetric theory. But what happens is that in the symmetry breaking case, you only have one metric. So the quantum numbers of that other metric get identified, get reshuffled into the gauge fields of the weak interaction. Does that clarify things a little bit more?
Maybe not for me, but maybe somebody. I'm still confused. That. I understand I have two gravitons initially, plus one scalar, which is 5. And then in your theory, I have one graviton and one massless gauge field, which is 4 degrees of freedom. So I'm still asking.
So the massless gauge field is a triplet under SU2. So that's 2 times 3 equals 6.
Okay. Okay, maybe.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But the key here is that in the parity symmetric cases, you have a bimetric theory. And in our case, the parity violence, we have a one metric. So those quantum numbers from the bimetric theory get reshuffled into the gauge degrees of freedom.
Okay.
That and that scalar mode. That's the magic. That's where the magic happens.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the intuition from the Higgs mechanism should be useful here as well. Because that's what happens in the Higgs as well. You have a ghost, a tachyonic mode that gets reshuffled into a massive vector mode that violates the SU2 symmetry. So that's a similar kind of idea. But that's a great question, by the way, and I think it should be pursued. That connection should be pursued in more detail. There's something very deep there, I believe. Any more questions?
I have a question, but maybe it's more for Lee because Stefan probably does not know this prehistory. Lee, there was kind of old work by Peter Pelden, right, which was very along the same philosophy, namely one wants to look at general relativity in connection variables and then augment the internal group to incorporate other interactions. And then he succeeded up to some approximations, right? It was not exactly gravity coupled with Young-Mills, but there were correction terms and so on. So first remark is that what is the relation between what he was doing and what you are doing? My belief is that the relation is just that you are taking, if you like, for him, the gravity gauge group was just, in your language, right SU2. And what you are saying is that his extension is also at the left SU2. Is that correct?
So let me fill in some of the history. Kirill found that by taking the SU2, the purely left-handed SU2 Lebesgue action, and adding this new dimension 4 term, B wedge B times the psi square trace, he could get a new class of pure spin 2 theories. So that was step one. And then I took the same idea of extending Lebesgue, but tried it with Peter Pelden's idea of extending the gauge group G to be a larger group that had a subgroup of the Lorentz group times an internal gauge theory, an internal gauge symmetry that became the Young-Mills factor. So I found, basically, using Kirill's idea, I found a way to write the Lagrangian version of Peter Pelden's idea. Then there occurred a puzzle. If you took just the Lorentz group for the gauge group, you could read it two ways. You could read it as a theory of gravity which is the symmetric phase, the way that we first investigated it, that Simone did the best work on, which turned out to be the biometric theory with the ghost. Or you could read the same theory, treating it as I had treated the Peter Pelton's idea. And the insight is that these were really two phases of the same equations of motion, two kinds of solutions of the same equations of motion. One taking a parity symmetric set of solutions, which led to Monet's version of the biometric theory with the ghost, or taking a different set of solutions to the same equations of motion, which arise from shifting one of the, say, the right-handed sector, shifting the right-handed sector of solutions around a different vacuum before expanding. And so the insight is that you can read the same theory has solutions which read as a biometric unstable theory, or as a theory of gravity coupled to an SU2 Yang-Mills theory.
But is this an exact statement, or is this an approximation statement when you do expulsion? Because Stefan had this transparency, which said that we arrive at a leading order action.
Yes. So since we have this small parameter, which is G, it's a dimensional parameter, but with the cosmological constant, you can make a dimensionless parameter, so you can expand on that dimensionless parameter. And there are new interactions, and the new interactions are on page 27, with the title "New Interactions Dark Hypercharge." So these are small. They're down by factors of Newton's constant squared, but they are properly going to be very small. But nonetheless, they may have consequences either for particle physics phenomenology or for cosmology.
And finally, I mean, at some stages, Stefan was referring to new theory of gravity. But it seems to be just gravity coupled with some matter then. Is that correct, or am I missing something?
Yeah, I made an incorrect statement. It's just gravity connected to new matter coupling.
Well, I like to look at it as the dynamics is not the dynamics of general relativity. The dynamics is Lebesgue dynamics extended in the way that Kirill and I studied. And so this is not just general relativity. But if you take the Lebesgue point of view, it's the first and the simplest way you would extend general relativity. And I might add, since the new term is dimension four, if you think in a renormalization group language, you should have all the terms of dimension four there. So it's a natural extension to study. And it has this consequence.
But I mean, even the biometric theory can be regarded just as general relativity with some additional matter field. So, are you saying that that is not possible in this version that you are talking about, or are you saying that that's possible but you prefer to look at it as a new gravity theory?
If you just wrote down the outcome, say as it is on slide. Let me get the slide numbers. 27, 20, and 27 for the leading order and the higher order terms. You could just write these couplings down, but you wouldn't. But there's a kind of coupling constant unification because there's only one new parameter in the whole scheme, which is the small g, which is the coupling constant of the one dimension four term that's been added. So as is common with unification schemes, the payoff is that there's unification of the coupling constant. So particularly, as on slide 20, the Yang-Mills coupling and the theta angle are expressed in terms of just three constants, Newton's constant, the cosmological constant, and this new constant, small g. And this gives constraints for phenomenology. And it's not trivial. A point to be emphasized is that to get small Yang-Mills coupling constant as natural for the electroweak interaction is non-trivial in this setup.
Yeah, let me add that, all of the, to emphasize what Lee said, all of the activities in the early parts of the year 2000, the so-called brain roll Randall syndrome, was designed to get a small Yang-Mills coupling for the weak interaction. And we're seeing in this scheme, without doing any kind of Randall syndrome, that it is possible in terms of G Newton and lambda, the cosmological constant.
Yeah, I find myself like Laura before. I'm still not clear. So if I look at the transparency 20, right, the first two terms are exactly Einstein action with the cosmological constant, if I think in terms of subdual connection in the unprimed spinorial variables. And if I think of the primed spinorial variables as representing Yang-Mills theory, then you've got a bunch of Yang-Mills terms there. So the equations of motion would be exactly, for the gravitational part, that Einstein's tensor is equal to some matter terms which are coming from Yang-Mills theory, which is here represented by the coupling constant G of Yang-Mills and the triplet of vector fields, which are labeled by the prime spinorial indices. Now, I agree that there are non-trivial couplings between Yang-Mills thing itself, but that is a statement about this theory has some specific built-in, if you like, couplings between Yang-Mills fields themselves, the interactions and so on, and I'm agree
yes.
that. But I can just think of it as gravity coupled with some matter, and the matter happens to have some special things. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I think it's.
Go ahead.
Lee, you were going to say something?
You go ahead.
Okay, so I have a slightly different philosophy, which is I first of all I agree with Abai's point here, but I would say that in that case, if I write, let's think about Kaluza-Klein theory. In Kaluza-Klein theory, the philosophy there is that I have some higher dimensional metric, and I have a higher dimensional gravity theory that I decompose into a small, a lower dimensional theory plus matter field. So the people that think of Kaluza-Klein, they think there's some benefit to working in higher dimensions because you have a vacuum Einstein equations in that theory. But, projected down to lower dimensions, I have something that's not vacuum, let's say. Well, in our case, I think it's a similar kind of philosophy, but I think it's more powerful in the sense that it is sort of like a Kaluza-Klein. We have this four-dimensional gravity theory, which is this extended gravitational theory. Which appears to just, to not have matter couplings at that level. It's purely formulated as a geometric theory. But it's in four dimensions. There's no higher dimensional theory. But the way the connection splits up actually becomes equivalent to, it contains in it, in a symmetry broken phase, what does look like general relativity coupled to matter, but it turns out that this matter is part of the geometric structure of this higher, of this other theory that is symmetric or quote-unquote unified. So that's just my philosophy on that take. It's sort of like a connection version of Kaluza-Klein. Lee, I don't know if Lee agrees to that.
I agree. So this is exactly what also Peter Pelton's philosophy a long time ago, and so I agree with this philosophy very much. But my question is, my follow-up question
is... You should be very happy with that. You should be happy with that. It's all geometry.
But on transparency 20, however, this is only a leading order action, right? Because you ignore some terms that came from the original totally unified action. Is that correct? So this is only an approximate version of the full unified theory.
You mean with alpha not equal to zero? You mean with the FF dual term not being there?
No, may I?
No, it's more than that, I thought.
Yeah, I'll let Lee take that.
So the theory we're talking about is on slide 12, and that's the complete theory. And it has one new coupling constant, which is little g squared. With little g squared equal to zero, it's a version of a Fibonacci action for the Lorentz group. And so it's a completely specified theory with one new coupling constant, little g squared. In the asymmetric solution, the shift it's on page 18 in the middle of the page. Shift is the B A prime B prime, rather than being forced to satisfy the simplicity conditions that come from the psi equations of motion. Before you apply the psi equations of motion, you shift it to the term proportional to F, which discovers a new vacuum, plus correction in little g to the sixth. And so the leading order, we're talking about little g to the sixth times the appropriate factor of the cosmological constant, maybe you mentioned this. And the leading order, it is slide 20, but the corrections are completely computable and completely already specified. And the restrictions amongst the different coupling constants are unavoidable and are already specified. So it is a genuine unification in the sense that there are consequences that are strict for values of the coupling constant after symmetry breaking, values of the coupling constant after symmetry breaking, as well as for higher order interactions.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Any other questions? Okay, if there are no further questions, let us thank the speaker again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. See you all soon.